This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Iranian Foreign Minister has called on the West to adopt a realistic stance in the JCPOA revival talks and make a serious and effective decision with regards to the removal of sanctions. President Putin slams NATO's allegations about Russia's plans to invade Ukraine. And also ahead, the UK's biggest retailer raises the alarm about soaring food prices as the country braces for a sharp increase in the cost of energy caused by a decade's high inflation. Thank you for joining us. And our top story, the Iranian foreign minister has called on the West to adopt a realistic stance in the JCPOA revival talks and make a serious and effective decision with regards to the removal of sanctions. In a phone call with his Chinese counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the West must demonstrate its meaningful departure from the failed policies of the former US administration. He said this is possible through the removal of all sanctions inconsistent with the 2015 deal and the adoption of serious measures to provide guarantees that the US will not abandon the deal again. For his part, the Chinese foreign minister said the US's unilateral withdrawal from the deal in 2018 has inflicted damage on Iran and violated its legitimate rights. Wang Yi said Beijing supports Tehran's reasonable demands and proposals in the talks in Vienna. Negotiators from Iran and the P4+1 group of countries are set to resume the eighth round of Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagheri-Kani will head for the Austrian capital on Tuesday and is expected to meet the European Union's coordinator Enrique Mora later in the day. The negotiators have been back in their capitals for the past few days to make political decisions about how to move forward with the talks. Tehran demands a complete and verifiable removal of anti-Iran sanctions. It also expects guarantees that the US will not withdraw from the deal as it did in 2018. Our correspondent in Vienna, Homolezki, has been watching the developments in the talks closely. Listen to what she had to say to us.
A recent interview that the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Oryanov, who leads the Russian team here in Vienna during these talks, has had. And in that interview, he said that he believes that indeed we are at the final stage of these negotiations. And he said that the final draft, the document of the restored JCPOA, is, in his words, almost ready, and it is about 20 pages long. And he's also said that once and if there is an agreement, as we've discussed this before, there will be a period of 1 to 2 months, which is called a preparation period, before the JCPOA can actually be implemented in action. That means, of course, probably the time that would be needed for the verified removal of US sanctions.
Elsewhere, the Russian president says his country's military buildup is conducted on its own soil, dismissing as baseless allegations that Russia is posing a threat to Ukraine. Vladimir Putin made the remarks at a joint press conference with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, in Moscow. Putin warned that European countries will be drawn into a military conflict with Russia in case NATO admits Ukraine as a member. He expressed hope that the standoff over Ukraine will be settled through dialogue, referring to concerns that Moscow expects the West to respond to. During the conference, French President Emmanuel Macron talked about the security guarantees he has proposed to Putin.
Bâtir ensemble while respecting our fundamentals, building together concrete security guarantees for the member states of the European Union, for the states of the region, Ukraine, Georgia, Belarus, and for Russia. It is exactly the ambition we must pursue.
Macron expressed hope that diplomatic efforts could resolve the crisis. Prior to the two presidents' meeting, Moscow didn't set an optimistic tone. It said the meeting was unlikely to pave the way for, quote, a decisive breakthrough as the situation is too complex. Tensions over Ukraine have escalated in recent weeks. Moscow wants NATO to stop its eastward expansion in Europe and bar Ukraine from joining the military alliance. Meanwhile, the United States and Germany once again warn Russia against invading Ukraine. The two NATO allies say they'll be ready to act in the event of a war. In a press conference with the German Chancellor, U.S. President Joe Biden said diplomacy is the best way forward for all sides. Biden, however, suggested there could be a war in East Europe and urged Americans who are still in Ukraine to leave the country. He also warned that if Russia attacks Ukraine, the much-anticipated Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline project would be off the table. That's the pipeline that would take gas from Russia straight to Germany once it becomes operational. Olaf Scholz, for his part, vowed to continue funding for the economic stabilization of Ukraine. Earlier, we asked the researcher Greg Simmons about Russia's military buildup near the Ukrainian border.
I completely understand why Russia is moving troops in greater numbers towards its borders. I mean, there is an obvious potential hazard and risk for them, which is developing, and it's been not driven by Russia, it's been driven by NATO. And those members. I mean, you've had both the Ukrainian Defense Minister and Zelensky asking the West to stop hyping the conflict because they're naturally afraid of the potential results of this dangerous kind of escalation, starting with rhetorics but potentially ending much more dramatically.
Elsewhere, the United Kingdom is facing a rise in inflation at rates not seen in the past three decades. A major retail company is now warning that the worst is yet to come. Britain's biggest retailer, Tesco, says the prices of its products can go up as much as 5% in the months to come. The company blames the matter on the rise in energy bills. That's partly due to the cold winter, lower gas deliveries from Russia, and tensions in East Europe. Last week, the Bank of England raised interest rates for the second time in 3 months, after forecasting that the peak inflation will reach record 7% in April. Now, after a bumpy week of mass resignations at his office and growing calls for his resignation, the British Prime Minister is making changes to the makeup of the staff at his Downing Street residence, hoping to change his own Conservative Party members' mind about an imminent no-confidence vote. From London, Saeed Pourreza reports on the state of play in the so-called Partygate scandal.
New Communications Director Guto Harry walking into the Prime Minister's office carrying a bag of groceries. Another new face, Conservative MP Steve Barclay, now Boris Johnson's chief of staff, part of the Prime Minister's shake-up at number 10.
It's not actually driven by Boris. It's been driven by a faction that's trying to remove him. And the reason it's happening now is because we're at the mid-stage between general elections.
The new appointments come after five of the PM's most trusted Downing Street staff quit last week over Partygate allegations. And more changes are promised as he looks to turn the rising tide of letters of no confidence. Those letters follow allegations of parties held under the Prime Minister's roof during lockdown, when the rest of the people adhered to the strict social distancing guidelines. In total, 16 parties allegedly took place in 2 years of lockdowns. An inquiry conducted by civil servant Sue Gray, although published in its redacted form, only mentioned 4 of the parties, all of which pointed to a violation of the government's own rules. The other 12 are under investigation by the Metropolitan Police, who stepped in at the 11th hour asking Sue Gray not to release her inquiry in full, buying the Prime Minister more time. Despite public outcry and the calls from members of his own party on him to resign, Boris Johnson and those closest to him say the country should move on from the scandal.
This is an attempt actually to remove him, to put a Remainer or a globalist in charge for the next general election. That's what's really going on. I think Boris will stick the course and he'll probably be with us in 2024. And unless Labour finds someone better than Keir Starmer to stand against him in 2024, Boris is much more likely than Labour to win that general election in 2 years' time.
Yet other experts say that while he and his allies work in overdrive to shore up his future as Prime Minister, the fallout from the Sue Gray inquiry and the ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation hangs over Boris Johnson's head like a Damocles sword. Saipur is up, London.
Elsewhere, Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip have held a sit-in to show solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli prisons. Protesting at the Red Cross office in Gaza City, they have demanded an immediate end to Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shannon brings us more details in this report.
Advocates and families of Palestinian prisoners have protested at the Red Cross office in the besieged Gaza Strip in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian inmates languishing inside Israeli jails. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are suffering from medical negligence.
Israel is practicing systematic medical negligence against Palestinian prisoners. Currently, more than 700 prisoners are suffering from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical care. Palestinian prisoners also must not be treated inside military hospitals.
Hundreds of Palestinians are also being held in Israeli jails without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Islamic Jihad movement slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
As we stand here, we affirm our support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially those held under administrative detention. They have been refusing to attend courts for 38 days now because administrative detention is illegal and is a crime against Palestinians.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights and continue to languish behind bars as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are prisoners of war, and they must be treated according to international law and norms. Because we are under occupation, Palestinian prisoners need international protection, and Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners also suffer from prolonged solitary confinement and inhumane detention conditions.
Latest figures by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and children. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
People in Indian-administered Kashmir, the only Muslim-majority region in India, still have fresh memories of the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. As Sayed Ali Safi reports, people in the Himalayan region hailed the Islamic Revolution for promoting the culture of Islamic unity and the resistance against oppressive forces.
Iran and Kashmir have a long history of cultural, linguistic and ethnic ties dating back to pre-Islamic period. The arrival of great Iranian religious missionaries in Kashmir, particularly in the 14th and 15th century, cemented this bond further. The overwhelming Iranian influence in Kashmir earned the Himalayan region the sobriquet of Iran-e-Saghir, or Little Iran. In February 1979, following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Kashmir was among the first to wholeheartedly embrace it. They rejoiced at Iran's liberation from the clutches of the US-backed Pahlavi regime.
I remember when the news of triumph of Islamic Revolution reached here, people of all shades took to the streets in jubilation. Rallies and gatherings were held. Soon after the victory of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei visited Kashmir, followed by the other prominent revolutionary figures like Mahdavi Ghani and Golzadeh Ghafuri. The bond between Iran and Kashmir has only grown stronger over the years.
People were very minutely and very carefully watching the Iran Revolution at that time. And for a few reasons, Kashmir has been, you know, historically connected with Iran and Central Asia. There was a propagation of Islam here and a lot of people converting to the faith of Islam as a result of Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani. Hamdani brought economic pursuits like, say, binding industry, paper and binding industry at that time, 550 years back. And along with traditional handicrafts, which were, you know, flourishing at that time in Iran, he brought certain artisans, certain craftsmen, skilled people, and they came along with the propagation of faith.
Political observers and academics in this Muslim-majority region believe the Islamic Revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism struck a chord with people in Kashmir. They derived inspiration from it in their quest for freedom, justice and equality.
People of Kashmir saw it positively. They cooperated with it because there was already a prevailing atmosphere of Muslim unity in Kashmir those days. They joined the gatherings which were celebrated in connection with the celebration of Islamic Revolution and as a message for Islamic unity and the upliftment of the downtrodden peoples of the world.
As the world marks the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, people here in Kashmir take immense pride in being the advocates of this great movement that has championed the cause of Islamic revival and resistance against the arrogant powers of the world. Sayyid Ali Safir, Indian administered Kashmir.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Islamic Revolution revives a Muslim woman's model. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in the 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Iran's Islamic Revolution triumphed with the presence of the whole Iranian nation from all walks of life. Yet, women played a very outstanding and effective role in this regard. Before the revolution, the Western view on women was dominant in Iran, and the Shah regime had done its best to fight all human values in women to turn them into the tool of implementing the American and European goals in the country. The instrumental look on women had begun since 19th century and reached Iran in early 20th century, but it reached its climax in 1970s with the growth of materialistic thoughts and technological and cinematic progress. Thus, secularism spread all over the country. This thought deemed no value for religion in society and politics, and limited it to individual life. Europe and the United States were introduced as the examples of progress and ideal life, and religion was introduced as the enemy of modernism and progress. The first ruler of the Pahlavi regime, Reza Khan Mir Panj, was an illiterate and self-conceited man who was a servile stooge of colonialists. In view of this, he blindly followed the dictates of his masters in the West, and as one of his first steps in modernizing Iran, he ordered the prohibition of hijab by women. Thus, the military and police of the regime would beat women and force them to remove their chador and scarf in public. Many ladies preferred not to go outdoors for years to keep their chastity and dignity. As his date was expired, Reza Khan was dethroned by the British, and his equally servile son, Mohammad Reza, was brought to the throne by Britain. Mohammad Reza continued his father's path. He left no stone unturned to change the Iranian lifestyle into a Western one. He himself was a licentious man to the extent that some writers wrote down his immoral, behind-the-scene lifestyle in their books and memoirs. Ali Shahbazi was one of the forces of the Shah's special guard who wrote in his memoir, "From the time of Asadullah Alam's premiership, his ministry had set up a special center for entertainment of Shah. Their job was to bring married women, beautiful girls or wives, and daughters of those who wanted to obtain a position for the Shah." The great leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, said on the oppression and injustices that women had suffered during the Pahlavi regime, "Woman has been oppressed in two phases. One was during the Jahiliyyah, or the period of pre-Islam ignorance, which Islam did a favor to human being and took woman out of the injustice and oppression she was in. The other one was in our Iran that woman was oppressed, and it was during the era of the former Shah and his successor. Claiming that they want to liberate woman, they wronged women. They took woman down from the position of nobility and dignity that she had. They turned woman from the position of a spirituality into an object. And in the name of freedom, free women and free men, they took freedom away from woman and man and made women and youth immoral." Imam Khomeini believed that woman has a dignified and lofty status. She can reach the highest degree of spirituality while engaging in scientific, political, and social activities. He said that the ultimate goal for mankind, regardless of their gender, is to get proximity of God. Being a servant of God and worshiping Him is not limited to gender. The Imam said, "Woman is a human, and that's a great human. Woman is the educator of society. It is from the woman's lap that humans are trained. It is from the woman's lap that man ascends to heavens. Happiness and misery of countries depend on woman. Woman makes human being through her correct training and develops the country through her correct training." Imam Khomeini then refers to the view of Islam and the beautiful conduct of the Prophet of Islam toward woman, saying, The history of Islam is witness to the unbounded respect of the Messenger of God to his daughter. To this noble child, Lady Zahra, peace be upon her, to show that woman holds a special greatness in society to the extent that, if it is not superior to man, it is not less than him. Imam Khomeini used to recommend women to strive in acquisition of knowledge and attaining moral virtues, as they are the source of happiness and every good thing for society. Years into the victory of the Islamic Revolution, effective efforts have been made to survive women's dignity in Iran. Muslim women of Iran have achieved many progresses in a variety of domains, such as sciences, sports, technologies, arts, and so on. They have strongly proved that having hijab is by no means an obstacle on the way of reaching pinnacles of progress. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "Woman, in the logic of Islam, has a perfect model and a structure. An Islamic woman is the creature which has faith and chastity. She holds the most important part of training human being. She is effective in society. She has scientific and spiritual growth. She is the administrator of the very important family center and the source of calm for the male gender. All these exist beside female characteristics like fineness, tender-heartedness, and preparedness for reception of divine rights. And this is the model of the Islamic woman. On the contrary, there has always been a deviated model in history. Today, that deviated model is the Western woman, whose characteristic, instead of those outstanding and lofty ones, which we mentioned for Islamic woman, is to be able to draw the attention of men and please them. Thus, the Western woman is characterized by nakedness. You can see that a man should be fully clothed in their ceremonies, while a woman should be as naked as possible."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today's topic is different of opinion in Islam. I think we have in Surah Hujarat, Ayah 13, that we have created you from different nations and tribes in order to identify.
Yes.
No, well, the purpose is in order to identify and know each other better, isn't
yeah.
it? So this difference of opinions, races, languages.
Difference of opinions, I said it before, that the lifestyles differ, you know. Mm-hmm. There's this saying I've been looking for a long time. And the story of me reading it is a very nice story, actually. I was going to a majlis, and then I went into the Marashi Najafi library. It's a long story short. I opened the book, and the first thing that came up to my eyes was that the way that the imam used to respect people who were from more outside the Arab lands, the Persians, it was different from the ways that he would respect the people from the Arab lands. That really just popped up to my mind, that there are some, you know, let's say notions, ideas, that, for example, in the Arabic, if you stand up, it's a sign of respect. Kissing the hands is a sign of respect for the knowledgers and scholars. In the West, for example, it's kind of a respect that you don't stand up. Because if you stand up, it's kind of like you're scared of him.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
What I want to say here is that there are different ethics. Okay. Cultures, etiquette. You know, the food that we eat really just displays that this effort, different ethics, you know?
Yeah.
And that really just shows you that the difference of our opinions, even though they are different to some extent, at the end of the day, there might be, you know, those larger notions of respect, of humbleness.
Yes.
The way that being humble, what the Prophet did is different than the, the way of being humble, for example, in the Arab manner is different than the way of being humble in the American manner, for mm-hmm. example. And, you know, even the FBI have this. I seen it on YouTube, actually. Okay. And the way that you hold flowers is different. You hold flowers because in society it's rude to hold flowers like this. Yes. So you hold it the opposite manner in Eastern Europe.
But the picture that is shown to you in today's media is also important. Sometimes the people are believing the picture that is shown to them. You know, Professor Edward Said in this book, Orientalism. I think you have read this book, Brother Habib, that this is a good book. You know, the picture that is shown to the world out of the Arabs sometimes is believed by themselves. Okay, we were barbaric, we were backward, you know, we had nothing.
Just look at the religion itself.
Yeah.
I believe, yes, you have to look at the religion by itself. Okay. But then comes this sophisticated topic of al-husn wal-qubh al-aqliyyin. You know, trying to see what is good and bad only with your intellect.
Yes.
Is the brain capable of doing so or not? Okay. And if it is capable, to what extent? Mm-hmm. Is it everything? It's truly studied in theology, in Islamic theology, for its importance in al-adl, or the just of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, especially in debate with the Asha'ira. And so at the end of the day, how are you? Who are you? My better question. Who are you to judge what is barbaric or not?
I'm a poor host who is acting.
No, not you, not you. The other guy. Not you.
I know.
I'm just saying that. Okay. Who are you to judge this is barbaric or not? Who are you to judge this is terror or not terror? Who gave you the salahiyya or the right and the authority to say this is barbaric and this is not barbaric? This is Stonehead, this is not Stonehead. I see
unless you knew you created yourself, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. That's the point. Yes. You have a creator. Why do you follow the laws of your of the brains of others? Mm-hmm. Right? Look.
Oh.
People who see that women are wearing too much cover and are modest, they see them as what? Barbaric people. People that are being forced. Mm-hmm. They themselves, the woman that's wearing hijab, she's like, "No. I love this. I see myself as a human being when I do this." So who gave you the right to judge?
Yes. Okay, that's all right. So Prophet Muhammad, out of his prophethood, and out of the message and the mission that was put on his shoulder, to some extent, or it's better to say in better words, as a prophet of Allah, had to respect all the people. But what about the imams? I mean, for example, what do we have? Do we have any evidence of Imam Ali alayhi salam showing any kind of disrespect to his or intolerance towards his enemies or those who were against him?
Well, obviously, when we look at the history, we see that there was always a matter of respect. For example, a guy came to Imam Hassan alayhi salam and he was abusing him literally, and he never knew, he didn't knew at that time when he entered the Medina that it is Imam Hassan. He was from Umayyah, he came from Syria.
Okay.
But Imam Hassan, when he saw him, obviously, he took him to his house. He said, it looks like you are a stranger. You came to this city for the first time, so you don't have any place for living. You don't have anything to eat, so I give you a place to live. I bring food for you. And also, so with the hospitality which he saw from Imam Hassan, he asked the people, who is he? And they said, he's the same guy who you were abusing when you entered the city of Medina. So this action changed that guy. And he said, the things that I have heard about you in Syria is totally different. What I see in you. Mm-hmm. So basically, the characteristics of Imam or the history of Imams, it shows us that they had the respect of even the enemies.
Okay.
When they were as a guest. You know, in Arab tradition, obviously, when there is someone as comes as a guest, even if it is your enemy, you need to respect.
Mm-hmm.
And we cannot see this culture in West. You know, can you imagine that an enemy enters to an American's house and he respects him just because of being a guest? No, they don't even allow them to enter the house. So basically, there's a difference of the culture, as brother has said. So we cannot judge things upon what it is said through one's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main thing. But obviously, yes, we can see that in the life of Imam, especially in the life of Imam Ali. Even if there were a difference, he has shown respect to a level in order to save Islam. Because for us, the main thing is Islam.
Yes.
This is very important. So we need to save this religion because of which we exist, obviously, which is the cause of our creation. This is the deen, this is the Islam.
Yeah.
And obviously, in order to save Islam, we have to do respect.
Just look at Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza's dialogues, you know, with the non-Muslims in the Ma'mun's court, Brother Habib.
Yeah.
The dialogues and the conversations of Imam Reza, alayhi salam, you know, answering their questions, you know, based on their
debating
own books.
Debating with them.
Debating and discussing, you know. All you could see is respect, non-respect, you know.
It really goes back to this. Imam Reza, alayhi salam, had confidence. We said that before, yeah, that the confidence that Islam has, and like how it's very clear for us, he's the divine knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth. Okay. You know, you have a question, you know, you go and ask the Imam. That is the use of Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam and the rest of the Imam salawatullah alayhi. And you see that, yes, exactly. Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, the way that he used to talk with the religious people, the scholars at the time, he would debate with them in a manner, not only with respect, but with divine knowledge and knowledge of their own books. And he would return them to their own books. Mm-hmm. Like he would tell them that it's stated in your books, this and that. One of the scholars was like, oh, really? Is this stated? He says, yeah, go look. And then the people around were like, yeah, it's available. What do we do now? He says, we can't do anything. We submit to Imam Ruba.
That's another manner of dialoguing. Like, yeah. So we need to do some dialogues. It's not just talking about your own opinions, but to know about the other person's.
But the concept of respect, see, when it goes back to arguments, we even have this in logic, right? In the third chapter of logic, where they search for the, you know, jadaliyat,
yes,
and arguments and debates. Sometimes it's kind of fun to, you know, tease and poke your opponent. Why? Because you're in an argument. You have people watching. I don't like to get into arguments personally, but when I get in an argument that I don't like to be in, I start to make fun of the other person. Mm-hmm. This is me personally talking.
Okay.
I make fun of him and, you know, just, you know, bug him a little bit, get him a little angry. When he gets angry, usually what happens is that he opens his mouth too much. He vents. Let him vent. And then you just calmly answer. When you do that, even though your answer is not as strong as you'd like it to be, the audience will see, oh, al-hilm ghita'un satir. Adherence is a very modest cover.
Yes.
And see, even though it's a weak answer, mm-hmm, but it's coming from modesty, you make him quiet. Mm-hmm. See, that's the beauty of arguing and poking fun of, you know, some of your points in some situations. But at the end of the day, there's always that respect.
How to present a
and
lecture?
You have seen, like, all the time he was talking loudly and I was calmly answering.
Yes. Yeah, but it doesn't always work with Habib, especially with Arabs.
I'm just joking.
Okay. That's all right. You're taking on Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, you know how he dealt with the difference of opinions, especially with the bid'ah, the innovations that some of the past caliphs, there were three other past caliphs. I was talking, I'm precisely talking about the second.
Mut'atan.
The Mut'atan, the Taraweeh prayers. When Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam wanted to, you know, come and tell him that these are innovations, this is not the right path, they screamed at his face, wa sunnat umara. When Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, at the beginning, they asked him to come become caliph, he said that I will judge and order with what the Prophet and the Quran came and ordered. They said, no, you would do what the Shaykhain did. He said, no. And that is why he didn't accept it for the second time. And then they came back the third and fourth time until that finally they accepted with the rules and conditions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, which at the end of the day, they didn't accept. Mm-hmm. So Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, ruhi lahu al-fida, wanted to do a couple of things, but was unable to because of the difference of opinions. And what's important for me here is that he saw the greater good. What was the greater good? The unity of Muslims was more important than showing that this is right and this is wrong. And that is also something that we always have to keep in mind whenever we're debating with different of opinions. Whenever I have a difference with Ata, for example, because he believes in the stuff that Suroosh brought up. For example.
Come on, man. I'm not believing in that, bro.
For example.
For example.
For the sake of the show, I have to, you know, just be quiet in some situations.
Okay, that's all right.
I'm playing around. He doesn't believe in any of those, huh?
No. I do not believe in any. Neither you know, any what you say, bro. Okay, that's all right. Okay, so, yeah, I have this Hurriya, freedom of self. Okay. May Allah help us, you know. The difference with the past generation is that, Brother Habib, we are now so much bombarded with different articles, different,
you know, news parts, you know, on the media, you know. The people in the past used to sit out on the corner reading out the Quran, you know.
No. It's not always like that, like how you state. People during that time didn't have anything other to do than talk. Nowadays, yes, it's much easier. Mm-hmm. But don't deny the fact that they were also, you know, proposed to differences of opinions and stuff like that. It's available. Yes. Now it's easier, yes, because the other day I was opening the Explore my Instagram account, right? And then I see flat earthers, those who believe in flat earths, conspiracy theorists. I see, for example, those who believe in this kind of concept or this kind of conspiracy, this kind of idea, this kind of religion. I've seen people who believe in, you know, in the devil's worship, or people who like to, you know, I've seen their accounts. All of it is on Explore. With just a couple of touches of a screen, you know, you could see the different opinions that are available. And it just intrigues you to try to understand them more. It's available in human beings, you know. Like, he's different. Why is he different? You want to know what's the difference between you and him more. So you want to know more. And the more you know, you'll get misconceptions. You'll get doubts. And that is why it's important to always have a base.
Yes.
And always return to Quran. Always recite the Quran. That is why we have it. One of the reasons why they state that it's important to always recite the Quran.
That's right.
Is that to review your beliefs. To, you know, to refresh your beliefs in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
At least attending a session which is on muraqabah, you know, giving you warning and cautious, you know.
If you want to refresh your beliefs, don't come to the show.
Yo, pieces of advice. You have to be given pieces of advice, you know. That's right. Attending the lectures of the ulama, listening to them every day, just reminding yourself of the truth and the facts. That's all right. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen and brother Habib, for your presence in the program. Viewpoints on Difference of Opinion. It was very kind of you. And thank you, Mashdi, listeners for listening to us. More information. Visit our website at parstree.com/ and Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in life, a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Amnesty directly calls on the USA, the European Union, and its member states and the UK to recognize that the Zionist regime is committing the crime of apartheid and other international crimes. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Romana Rubo, writer and the managing editor of the Palestine Chronicle. This article is published under the heading 10 Things You Should Know About Amnesty International Report on Apartheid Israeli Regime. Here's the story. On Tuesday, February 1st, London-based international human rights group Amnesty International released an extraordinary report which labels the Zionist regime an apartheid regime. The report calls for the Zionist regime to be held accountable for its practices against Palestinians. The 280-page document entitled "The Zionist Regime's Apartheid Against Palestinians, Cruel System of Domination and Crime Against Humanity" outlines how the Zionist regime segregates and controls Palestinians in order to maintain Jewish hegemony. Though to be fully appreciated, the Amnesty International document must be read in its entirety. So, here we have 10 top points raised by the International Human Rights Group. Number one, what is apartheid? After defining apartheid as a violation of public international law, a grave violation of internationally protected human rights, and a crime against humanity under international criminal law, Amnesty in its report describes the Zionist regime's intent to oppress and dominate Palestinians. Since its establishment in 1948, Israel has pursued an explicit policy of establishing and maintaining a Jewish demographic hegemony and maximizing its control over land to benefit Jewish Israelis while minimizing the number of Palestinians and restricting their rights and obstructing their ability to challenge this disposition. Number two, geographic scope. According to Amnesty, the system of segregation extended beyond the so-called Green Line to the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which the Zionist regime has occupied in 1967. Quote, "Today, all territories controlled by Israel continue to be administered with the purpose of benefiting Jewish Israelis to the detriment of Palestinians, while Palestinian refugees continue to be excluded. Although Israel's system of apartheid manifests itself in different ways in various areas under its effective control," the report reads, "it consistently has the same purpose of oppressing and dominating Palestinians for the benefit of Jewish Israelis who are privileged under Israeli civil law regardless of where they reside," unquote. Number three, treatment of Palestinians. The Zionist regime should be labeled an apartheid regime because Palestinians are treated by the Israeli regime differently based on its consideration of them as having a racialized non-Jewish Arab status. Number four, territorial fragmentation, segregation, Jewish settlements. Starting in 1948, the Zionist regime pursued a policy of territorial fragmentation and segregation, Amnesty said in its report. Israel chose to coerce Palestinians into enclaves within Israel, and following their military occupation in 1967, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, they have appropriated the vast majority of Palestinians' land and natural resources. They have introduced laws, policies, and practices that systematically and cruelly discriminate against Palestinians, leaving them fragmented geographically and politically, in a constant state of fear and insecurity, and often impoverished. Meanwhile, Israel's leaders have opted to systematically privilege Jewish citizens in law and in practice through distribution of land and resources, resulting in their relative wealth and well-being at the expense of Palestinians. They have steadily expanded Jewish settlements on occupied Palestinian territory in violation of international law, the report adds. Number 5, legal segregation. Amnesty describes the way the Zionist regime has used military rule as a key tool to establish a system of oppression and domination over Palestinians across both sides of the Green Line, applying it over different groups of Palestinians and almost continuously since 1948. Israel maintains a system of fragmentation and segregation through different legal regimes that ensure the denial of nationality and status to Palestinians, violate their right to family unification and return to their country and their homes, and severely restrict freedom of movement based on legal status, unquote. Number 6, restrictions of movement and apartheid wall. Amnesty denounces the closure system imposed on Palestinians within the occupied territories and between the OPT and Israel, gradually subjecting millions of Palestinians who live in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and Gaza Strip, to ever more stringent restrictions on movement based on their legal status. These restrictions are another tool through which Israel segregates Palestinians into separate enclaves, isolates them from each other and the world, and ultimately enforces its domination. Moreover, the report highlights how the 700-kilometer fence or wall, which Israel continues building mostly illegally on Palestinian land inside the occupied West Bank, has isolated 38 Palestinian localities in the West Bank and has trapped them in enclaves known as seam zones. Number 7, political rights. According to Amnesty, the Zionist regime's version of democracy overwhelmingly privileges political participation by Jewish Israelis. Limitations on the right of Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories to participate in elections are accompanied by other infringements of civil and political rights that limit the extent to which they can participate in the political and social life. This has included racialized policing of protests, mass arbitrary arrest, and the use of unlawful force against protesters during the demonstrations against Israeli repression in both occupied territories and OPT. Number 8, dispossession of Palestinian land. Amnesty illustrates how, since its creation on the ruins of Palestinian towns and villages, the Israeli regime has enforced massive and cruel land seizures to dispossess and exclude Palestinians from the land and homes. Suffice it to say, in 1948, Jewish individuals and institutions owned around 6.5% of Mandate Palestine, while Palestinians owned about 90% of the privately owned land there. Within just over 7 years, the situation has been reversed. Amnesty also mentions the Israeli laws and regulations currently implemented by the Israeli regime authorities to carry out demolitions of Palestinian property in East Al-Quds, including absentee property law of 1950 and the administrative matters law. In East Al-Quds, the Zionist regime transferred from regime to Jewish national organizations and institutions, many of which serve Jews only, while the legal title of the land remained in the regime's name. Number 9, the Zionist regime's crimes against humanity. Amnesty's report analyzes three major categories of crimes against humanity. That's to say, the inhuman and inhumane acts as prescribed, respectively, by the Apartheid Convention and the Rome Statute. First, it condemns the forcible transfer of Palestinians explaining that since 1948, the Zionist regime has demolished tens of thousands of Palestinian homes and other properties across all areas under its jurisdiction and effective control. Second, the report addresses the issues of administrative detention, torture, and all ill treatment. The Zionist regime's systematic use of the administrative detention against Palestinians indicates that it is used to persecute Palestinians rather than as an extraordinary and selective security measure. The report also illustrates how the Zionist regime courts have admitted evidence obtained through torture of Palestinians, accepting the justification of necessity. Prompt, thorough, and impartial investigations by the Zionist regime authorities into allegations by Palestinians that they have been tortured are extremely rare, effectively giving endorsement to the crime of torture. Third, Amnesty strongly condemns the Zionist regime's unlawful killings and injuries, which were perpetrated outside the context of armed conflict during Israeli law enforcement activities in OPT, including during the suppression of protests, arrest raids, when enforcing travel and movement restrictions, and conducting house and search operations. And number 10, recommendations. Amnesty states in its report that dismantling this cruel system of apartheid is essential for the millions of Palestinians who continue to live in OPT, as well as for the return of Palestinian refugees who remain displaced in neighboring countries. Also, it urges the need for the international community to urgently and drastically change its approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and recognize the full extent of the crimes that the Zionist regime perpetrates against the Palestinian people. Amnesty directly calls on the USA, the European Union, and its member states, and the UK to recognize that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid and other international crimes, and use all political and diplomatic tools to ensure Israeli regime authorities implement the recommendations outlined in this report and review any cooperation and activities with Israel to ensure that these do not contribute to maintaining the system of apartheid. Finally, Amnesty calls on the International Criminal Court, ICC, to consider the applicability of the crime against humanity of apartheid within its current formal investigation, and on the United Nations Security Council to impose targeted sanctions such as asset freezes against Israeli officials most implicated in the crime of apartheid and a comprehensive arms embargo on the Israeli regime.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.